Good morning. Right now on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville, it's the Mind and Heart Show. For the next hour, it's thoughts and feelings and the way they affect our lives and the world we live in. The phone number in the studio is 434-284-9470. Now here's your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier.
Good morning, Charlottesville, and welcome to the Mind and Heart Show. I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier, and we're here every Saturday morning on WPVC 94.7 FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Our show deals with all matters of the mind and heart, including mental health issues, stress, life transitions, parenting, spirituality, relationships, and much more. Please visit our Facebook page at Mind and Heart Show and post a comment or a question. You can send us a tweet at MindHeartWPVC or an email at MindHeartWPVC@gmail.com. You can also stream the show live by going to our website, the station website, which is 947WPVC.org. So check us out on the website and join us there. This morning, I'm joined in the studio by my producer, Morgan Geyer. Thanks to Morgan, who's keeping everything running smoothly. And I'm very pleased to welcome my guest this morning, Becky Waybright, who is the executive director of SARA, the Sexual Assault Resource Agency, and we'll be talking today about that agency and what it offers to the community. So welcome, Becky. Good morning, and thanks for giving up your Saturday morning.
Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Welcome. So let's just start. Tell our listeners a little bit about your professional background in terms of how you got to this position with this particular agency, and then we'll go from there into talking some about SARA specifically.
Great, sure. I've been working at SARA now for about 3.5 years. I'm not new to this field, though. I worked in this field. Oh, golly, that's going to make me feel old to talk about how far back it was. But back in the late 80s to the early 90s, I was with the YWCA in Richmond, which is a joint domestic violence and sexual violence program. And then I moved to the statewide coalition that doesn't exist anymore because it's now merged with domestic violence programs, but it was the statewide coalition of rape crisis centers. Since that time, I've worked at a number of nonprofits. I was at the Free Clinic for a number of years here in Charlottesville, and I did a couple other different gigs here and there. And before I came to SARA, I was most recently working at the Housing Authority here in Charlottesville.
Okay, good. So tell us, what is SARA? SARA stands for the Sexual Assault Resource Agency, but what exactly do you do? What is the nature of the organization?
When I think about our organization, I essentially think about three different parts. We do direct services to survivors. We have a very strong prevention education program, and then we do a lot of outreach to the community. With our direct services, we have a 24-hour hotline that's available to anyone who has questions, concerns, somebody who's in immediate crisis and needs help. That hotline is available to anyone. Somebody who's having trouble sleeping in the middle of the night and just needs someone to help talk them down, that resource is available. We also provide services 24/7 to the UVA Emergency Department. If a survivor is there and comes in after an assault, the forensic nurse examiners would call us, and then we go and advocate for the survivor, unless the survivor says they don't want us, but most of the time they're very happy to have us there. With our direct services in-house, we can provide psychoeducational counseling. We do advocacy if somebody's going through the courts. We can help somebody advocate for them with other systems within the community. And then we also do therapy on site with our staff. And then we have a very strong primary prevention education program, where we're working with area schools. The goal with that is to hopefully keep perpetrators from developing and to help other students know how to intervene if they see something that's inappropriate. Each of our prevention programs are really specifically designed for that particular school. And we have a real, it's a great program. I'm really excited about that. Our outreach services work to both to let people know about our services in the community so that they can come to us. We also do training for allied professionals. We do general presentations to the community. We have a lot of social media presence, which has been really exciting to see that grow over the past, 6 months or so. All of that to try to get word out about our services so people can access them as needed.
Boy, that's great. Just full disclosure, I was a member of the CERB board in the early 90s and served for a while as president of that board. And just listening to you this morning, I'm struck with the incredible growth and the incredible expansion of offerings. I mean, it was sort of a very much smaller scale organization back when I was affiliated. So congratulations. That's just terrific.
Thank you. It's even just in my time there, it's been really exciting to see how it's grown and how it's really kind of strengthened and stabilized. It's challenging with small nonprofits. They often tend to work hand to mouth in a lot of ways and sort of often have financial crises. So it's been really nice to have the agency be a bit more stable so we can really look at what are the community needs and how can we meet them.
And so how many paid staff do you have now?
We always want to go around and count everybody's offices to figure out. We have about 10 paid staff, most all in full-time positions. And then we have some really small part-time positions that help us cover call on weekends. The goal of that is to be able to give full-time staff a bit of a break so that we can hopefully have weekends to do some things to rest and re-energize. But we have a pretty large staff.
Yeah, that's about threefold what it was back in the early 90s. So give us a little bit of the history of CERB, if you would. I think our listeners would be interested in how this organization came to be in Charlottesville.
Yeah, we started in 1974. We were incorporated as a nonprofit in 1979. And when I tell people about this, I think we literally did start with a group of people sitting around a kitchen table saying, this is a need, we need to do something, we need to help. It's very strong from a grassroots effort.
Right.
And I think that's part of what's made the agency strong and made it survive over some of the different challenges it's had over the years is because there has been a really strong belief in we need these services in our community. And there have been dedicated people here and there. I mean, we still have dedicated people, but who have really kind of done that extra effort to help the agency as it's gone through different transitions. So that's kind of how we started. Started with one part-time paid staff person and has grown from there. And a lot of that's been reflective of the whole movement around sexual violence and how do we support survivors and how do we work to prevent sexual assault from happening.
Yeah. And it's probably worth mentioning that this is not an agency or types of agency that you'd find in every community. I mean, Charlottesville is very fortunate to have CERB because in many localities, there's no such organization.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've worked statewide, so I've seen what's been done statewide. In most communities, a domestic violence program starts first. And then typically from there, they will add sexual assault services because they're aware of that when they're providing services for people who have been victims of domestic violence. But yeah, there are a lot of chunks of the state that if somebody does need services, they have to travel quite a ways. And I think in a lot of those areas, if there aren't services around, people don't access them.
Yeah, which is really unfortunate.
Yeah.
And I want to come back to this later, but again, the absence of preventative services too, I think is a huge gap, and we'll get into that shortly. And so you've alluded to this, but the mission really is to both prevent sexual violence, but also respond to those persons who have been victims of sexual violence.
Yes, absolutely. And we work with men, women, and children. We see survivors of all ages. Sometimes I hesitate to say how young we've seen because I know that can really upset people a lot, but we see a lot of kids. And of course, every time a kid comes to us, we have some caregiver around them or a parent around them. We don't work with offenders, but we have the non-offending parent. And oftentimes with kids, our work with the parents may be just as substantial as what we do with the kids. We work with partners of people who have been sexually assaulted. because oftentimes that person may want to know how to support their partner, but they don't know what to do, or they don't want to do something wrong. So those are resources that we can provide. So we have a great strength with our direct services.
And is the model at Sarah one that was sort of built from the ground up, or did you also incorporate, you know, looking around the country or whatever, portions of other similar organizations? I mean, what's the sort of evolution of the model?
I would say it was probably both. I know with our primary prevention education program, we've looked nationwide to try to, that's such a new and growing field that we've really worked nationwide to see what other places are doing. But with direct services, I think a lot of it has been just responding to what's the need of the person in front of us and trying to figure out, if we can't meet that need, can we find another resource in the community?
Right.
Trying to meet that person where they are and figuring out how we can help them. And we can't take away the trauma of a sexual assault, but we can help somebody figure out how to integrate it into their lives and move forward as strong as they can.
Yeah, that's great. So tell us a little bit about your staff in terms of what the particular duties are. I mean, I know you have a range of folks there.
Sure, absolutely. We have a child advocate who works with the kids. That's up to age 17 or 18, depending on when somebody might come to us. And the cases with kids are often different than with adults, because with kids, there's not a choice about reporting. It's more than likely going to have been reported to the police, and there will be other systems involved.
And let me just interrupt you and have you comment on the mandatory reporting law in Virginia, just so our listeners understand how that works.
Right. I think if any time anybody has any questions about whether they should report or not, they should call. There's an 800 number with Department of Social Services, because
right.
I would much rather have somebody err on the side of finding out they don't need to report than being concerned about something and not reporting.
Right.
When it comes to kids, I think we all have an obligation to protect them.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, there are certainly some mandated reporters. We are. Anybody who
teachers,
works in daycare, teachers, right.
Therapists.
Right.
I often was in a position of having to make a mandatory report when something would come to my attention when I was in practice.
Yeah, when that happens with us, we don't secretly hide that. We usually tell the parent, this is something I have to report.
Right.
And we can do this together, something like that, because it's really nice because we don't have to sit there and decide, is this bad enough? It's
yeah.
like, no, we make our report to the Department of Social Services, and
they go from there,
right. But with kids, because they do often come in through the criminal justice system or through a crime having been reported to the police, there are a lot more partners involved in that. So our child advocate really does have to work with a lot of those partners in the community when she provides her advocacy. And a lot of what our child advocate does, and both our direct services advocate who works with adults, part of their job is to kind of assess somebody for therapy, working with our therapist, and decide whether it's a good fit for our therapy program, whether there might be some other pressing issues that need to be addressed first, whether there might be a better referral resource. Sometimes it's something as simple as the person lives in an outlying county and they may be better served going someplace closer to where they live than coming to us, because it may just mean they'll show up and then be able to work through it.
Yeah.
We have a clinical director with our position, with our agency. That position's currently open. I'm hoping to fill it soon. That person sort of gives oversight for all of our direct services. We have the direct services advocate, which works with adult survivors. She also does different outreach pieces to some outlying agencies to try to figure out whether there are survivors there that need to be served. We have our two therapists, one's at 32 hours and one's at 24 hours.
And they're licensed mental health professionals?
They're MSWs. They're working on licensure now. Okay. They have licensed supervision, and both of them have experience in this field. And you probably already know this from colleagues. There's a special group of people in this world who want to work with people who have been victims of trauma and have that courage, really, to do that.
Oh, it's tough work.
Yeah, it is. And thankfully there are those people. I feel like it's my job to make sure they're getting the opportunities for self-care that they need, because it is really tough work. The flip side is you see some incredible progress and some incredible healing happening. Yeah. Right. And I can even see it sometimes with people in just terms of how they hold themselves physically from when they came to us the first time to when they come to, you know, when they're coming to us months later. So that's the plus side that we can really see, with people is that they can heal. I've told that to people. It's like, you can get through this.
Yes.
May not feel like it right now, but you can. We have our community outreach director, which does a lot of our social media. She's doing a lot of our outreach to allied professionals, working with our sexual assault response team. And she's doing the bulk of our social media, which is great. It's been really exciting to see our social media presence grow. And then we have three people that are working with our prevention program. And one of those also works with our volunteer program and coordinating our hotline volunteers. We have got a pretty strong staff.
And a lot of breadth there in terms of just what everybody's doing.
Yes, we all do. We all respond to calls to the emergency department.
Yeah,
that's just kind of goes with everybody's job.
And it brings to mind this issue of coordination with the emergency department and the forensic nurse with Foothills Child Advocacy Center, which for those of you that don't know is an agency in town that will interview a child in using a format which is designed to really hold up in court. There'd been a lot of pushback, I think, historically with attorneys taking advantage of poorly executed interviews with kids. And I think, speak to that.
Yeah, the Foothills program has done a great job. A part of it is to also limit the amount of interviews that a child has to go through.
Exactly.
Because it's especially depending on the age of the child, they're typically kind of baffled at what's going on. You know, they may know something wrong happened, but they're not quite defining it because it's typically a trusted person in their lives. And I think the interview process can really just confuse a child. And I think that's where it's nice to have a trained forensic interviewer who can do that, and then ideally the child doesn't have to go through multiple
That's
interviews.
A really important point. Thanks for raising it. But then also, coordination with the police, coordination with the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. I mean, you really are plugged in.
Yeah, I feel what comes with the child advocacy program is a multidisciplinary team, which we're a part of, and I think it's really strengthened our community's ability to be able to respond to kids and to be able to figure out what's the best solution. I think a lot of our Commonwealth attorneys are great at trying to figure out how can they best help the child. Certainly we want to hold the perpetrator accountable.
Yes.
But a plea bargain may be the best option because then that may be the best solution for everybody versus the child having to testify in court.
Oh, yeah, that's tough.
I feel like our Commonwealth attorneys have learned how to, sometimes they listen to us and sometimes it's really trying to find out what's in the best interest of the child.
Yeah. Speak for a moment, if you would, this question. I think most of us might think that if we pick up the paper, that most child sexual assault is done by strangers who sort of grab a kid off the street or whatever. But that's really not the case in terms of the proportion or the percentages of child sexual assault.
Yeah, the majority of time with the child, it's someone that they know. It may be a parent, a step-parent, maybe a family friend, maybe a sibling. That's not uncommon either, but it typically is someone that the child knows and the child has a reason to have a connection with or to be alone with, because you wouldn't think about that, a child, you wouldn't think about leaving a child alone with a sibling or a half-sibling or something like that. That would not be something a parent would think was the wrong thing to do. That it typically is a trusted person in the child's life.
Yeah, which is brings its own set of problems, I think, doesn't it, in terms of that fundamental trust being violated?
It is, but kids are incredibly resilient.
They are.
They're kind of amazing to watch, and they don't know another, their life is theirs, so they don't really know another life to compare it with. And I think one of the things that I think is so important about our services for children, when you look at adults that are victims of sexual violence, oftentimes they were victimized as a child.
Right.
So I think one of our best parts of our prevention is when we work with kids, because we can help them not be a victim when they become an adult.
Right. That's such a critical point. You know, there have been some fairly extensive studies on that, as you know, where untreated, it sort of creates almost a stance in life which may make you more vulnerable, because you're traumatized, you're a victim of sexual trauma.
Right. And I think if it's a kid may feel like, I wasn't able to stop it then, I can't stop it ever.
Yeah.
So I think that's where an intervention, even if it doesn't always happen to everybody's 100% satisfaction with it, can still make a critical difference for that child, if that child was listened to, if that child was believed, if that child was supported. Then it makes a difference in their development.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest this morning is Becky Waybright, who's the executive director of SARA, which is the Sexual Assault Resource Agency. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back in a moment with more questions for Becky. So please stay with us. If you're just joining us on the Mind and Heart Show, we're talking this morning to Becky Waybright, who is the executive director of the Sexual Assault Resource Agency here in Charlottesville, an agency that's been here, gosh, going on 40 years? 30
Pretty
years?
Close, yeah.
Yeah. talking about the growth of the agency and the incredibly important work they're doing in our community, and we're very happy to have Becky with us this morning. Becky, just getting back to SARA and the programs, say a little bit more about the preventative program. I know when I was on the SARA board, that was just beginning, and it was remarkable to see the impact in the schools, both in terms of kids learning about bad touch and good touch, and also kids, once the program was offered, perhaps coming forward to a guidance counselor with stuff going on at home. So broaden that discussion for us a bit, if you would.
Absolutely. I would be happy to. When I did this work in my prior life many, many years ago, a lot of what we did then when we talked about prevention was much more risk reduction. What can people, typically women, do to reduce their risk of being a victim of sexual violence? When I started back at SARA 3.5 years ago, that's the biggest area of change that I've seen. And we really look more now at what we call primary prevention education. A lot of that is helping young people. We still believe in the safety skills and those kinds of things. We're not ruling those kinds of things out, but really looking at how do we help kids, young people, develop empathy for each other? How do we help kids recognize inappropriate sexual jokes, things that might be sexual harassment, things that might be beyond flirting, and how do we help kids know how to respond to that if they see that in their peers? And when I'm talking about kids, we're typically working with middle school and high school age young people, really trying to change the culture that accepts sexual violence happening, and trying to make it so that we can change that culture so that people are saying, this is not acceptable. It's not appropriate to talk about people that way. It's not appropriate to give unwanted touch. And if somebody does see something like that happening, how they can potentially intervene and work with that. We're not currently working with younger kids. There certainly is a lot of programming out there that does work with that. But when we kind of had to focus our prevention program, we really felt like that middle school kids and high school kids were a population we could work with more strongly with our messaging.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about what's going on in that age group, certainly the whole onset of puberty and sexual hormones and, you know, the fact that kids these days can get access to some pretty horrible material online, it really does represent a huge challenge in terms of trying to just address some of the attitudes about sexual power and sexual abuse and sexual assault.
Yeah, and we want to help kids understand that it's okay to feel things sexually. It's not a bad thing, but that knowing what is really appropriate and what's kind of crossing the line and how to say if something is bothering them, and just really kind of helping give them skills. We work a lot on building bystander skills so that kids will know if they see something that's inappropriate, or they have a friend who says something that makes them that they don't think is right, that they will feel strong enough to stand up and say something about that. I think that once kids reach a certain age, they just value their peers' input so much more than adults. So
right.
if we can help those peers grow and know how to respond to things. I mean, ideally, there's only a small percentage of people that are perpetrators.
Right.
And if we can really try to help people potentially change at least the behavior of some of them early on, that maybe we can stop sexual violence from happening quite so much.
You know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, one of my constant frustrations when I was still in practice is I would get a referral to evaluate a kid, 99% of the time a boy, who had been some inappropriate behavior and would evaluate the kid, make recommendations, only then to get feedback that, well, yeah, but we don't have any money to provide that treatment. And then 10 years later, this now young adult is in my office wearing, a striped jumpsuit because his sexual assaulting behavior has escalated over that time. And it drove me crazy because, on the kids we did intervene, we could really change the trajectory of their lives and save so many people from being traumatized by their activity. It just was incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, prevention's an interesting field because it's hard to prove prevention. Some funders really want evidence-based proof, and we can't prove that what we go in and do in the schools keeps a perpetrator from potentially developing. What we can show is we can show attitudinal change. We can show, we do a lot of pre and post testing with prevention, but we'll show things like kids will say the statistics will improve in terms of kids saying that they're willing to intervene, that they recognize that some things are sexual harassment. So we can see an attitudinal change, which ideally we hope will make a long-term difference.
Yeah, that's great. Just a sort of unrelated question. It just jumped to mind. Wondering if Sarah has been involved in this recent increased awareness of human trafficking in our area. And it just occurred to me that's probably something that people would want to have Sarah participate in.
We have to some extent. We've also there is now an organization here in Charlottesville, the Arbor, which does work with sex trafficking. So that's an organization that we're connected with.
And okay.
Actually, one of my staff is on their board, so
okay.
We're aware of each other's services.
And is that their particular
yes,
target?
Yes, to work with trafficking.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. I think sometimes taking on another really big issue feels even more overwhelming.
Yes.
And in Charlottesville, what we do is we just start new nonprofits because that's the way Charlottesville works.
Right.
Fortunately, we've got a very supportive community
right.
that believes in supporting nonprofits. So.
But we probably have more nonprofits per capita than in many similar
cities. I think we do. I know
which
we're
is
really
wonderful.
High. Up. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It says both good and bad things about the community, mostly good.
So. Right. So getting back to what we were talking about earlier with kids, is there sort of a typical perpetrator of sexual violence against children, or is it just all shapes and all sizes?
Yeah, I think we find all shapes and all sizes. I think the perpetrator kind of, and you this is more your field than mine, but sort of tests out and kind of sees where he, because it typically is a he.
It's almost might, always a
yeah,
he.
Might be able to do that grooming or kind of find
yep.
some boundaries. It really can be somebody in all shapes and sizes. I think for parents, ideally they're teaching their kids early on how to name and label their body parts and giving them permission to talk about things related to that. Always telling their kids, you can come tell me anything. And just really being responsive if a kid brings up some sort of issue of concern or something they feel uncomfortable about and really listening to that. I think it's really tough for a kid when it may be their parent that's the perpetrator, because that really is supposed to be the top trusted person for a child. But hopefully there are other people that the child can go to,
be it
a guidance counselor, a teacher, or somebody like that.
Minister.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I would see frequently when I would see perpetrators would be that they have their own history of sexual trauma, and it gets reenacted. And again, it goes right back to that prevention point that you raised.
Yeah, I did. When I, you know, I'm so happy we do direct services, but my goodness, I'd like to have less people that needed them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It just would be a better world.
Yeah. And so often, again, I think, you know, once these folks get into treatment, the notion that they're somehow trying to redress their trauma by assuming, going from the position of having been powerless there to asserting sexual power. And it's such an unfortunate cycle that, you know, whenever we can break it, it's just so important to do so.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know I've talked with some of your staff in the past about that very issue, and just was so impressed with just their understanding of that dynamic and really reinforcing the importance of prevention.
Yeah, and we have...
And early intervention, sorry.
Right. Sometimes I tell people that we have a real luxury at our agency. I'm not saying our work isn't hard, but
right.
We work with the survivors. We believe the survivors. We stand up. We advocate for the survivor. So we don't really have to decide. I mean, it's our job is to believe that person who comes to us, and we do.
Right.
So in some ways, it makes our role easier than like the police who have to investigate and
or
have
the
to determine.
Commonwealth attorney, right.
Right. It's like our job is to advocate for that survivor, and that's what we do.
Yeah. And what important work that is. Yeah. So what's your view on whether we can prevent most child sexual abuse? Because, you know, that's a lot of what I know you deal with.
Yeah. I think what I'm seeing happening with some of the young people that we work with is really exciting. In a couple of our area high schools, we have what we call step-up groups. And this is where kids have come in and they've been identified as leaders in the school. And then they potentially bring in other kids that work with them. And then we work with them. And then they work to educate their peers. For instance, at one of our area high schools, our step-up group met with the baseball team and talked with the baseball team about things that, you know, what, I mean, a lot of it, what were things that girls do and don't like, and really trying to clarify. And it was the step up group was mixed, was co-ed, but the baseball team was all boys,
right.
But really talking with them a lot about these are things that girls don't necessarily like. And these are things that they do like. And when you think about kids that are either potentially going off to jobs or going off to college and giving them an opportunity to be able to talk with other people openly and honestly about different things that are, you know, they're not sexual assault. I think they would all have agreed sexual assault was bad, but if they're talking about inappropriate touching or coercing or
shaming or
right, or trying to talk their way into sex, we talk a lot about the affirmative consent, not just consent, but somebody being a full, active, participating partner if people do choose to be sexually active versus somebody being coerced into it or talked into it or pushed
right.
into it when they're not
pressure.
Really right.
Yeah. And you know, this goes to a larger point, which you know, would probably be a show in itself, but the issue of the continued sort of prevailing cultural views toward women and children. I mean, that's something that's bothered me in all my 43 years of work, because you know, very often with these perpetrators, there's a sense of entitlement. There's a sense of, I remember years ago, a case over in Augusta County, and the father, I think he'd 11 children. I think he'd molested every one of them. And when he came in, you know, it was sort of like, they're my property. What's the problem? You know, it's not your business. It's not law enforcement's business. And it's just maddening to see those
right.
attitudes.
When you look at some of the college campuses and some of the cases that have come up on college campuses, they're often, athletic teams,
fraternities,
and athletic teams, I think, actually come out worse sometimes than the fraternities. But they're typically people that have had a sense of entitlement,
right?
And I think that's and they feel like they have that right, or they've never had anybody say,
"You can't do that,"
right? Right?
Yeah.
So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, but it's fun with the high school kids that we're working with to really hope that they're going. We're kind of planting a seed of activism or nurturing a seed of activism that may already be within them, and helping them to know when they go, they may go to college, they may not, but that they can then spread that when they go out and become adults.
Yeah. And I know several young women that have really been transformed by that, in the sense that you know, they now have a strong resolve to sort of what's right and what's wrong, and they're going to advocate for it, and they're going to advocate for it with their friends, and they're going to talk about it with guys and say, whoa, wait a minute. And it's just, it's powerful stuff. Again, I don't know how you measure it necessarily, but it's when you see it, you know, it's really powerful.
Yeah, it is. It's exciting to see. It's just really some of the kids we work with, and I'm not doing it directly, so I just hear the stories from my staff, but some of the things that I hear are really exciting. We've been doing some work with Louisa County High School. We've been doing, it's a Green Dot is a national program. We're calling it Gold Dot there at Louisa County, but really they're again working to develop a group of students that have been chosen as leaders and help them to kind of look at the culture of their school and figure out if there are ways that it can be changed that can make sexual violence less likely to happen.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I just worry about so many of the messages that young people get and the confusing messages. And, you know, it's, you're up against the media, you're up against what's on the internet, you're up against so many things, but in no way that really makes the work more important.
It does, absolutely.
Oh, we were talking a moment ago about college and those sorts of school situations. And tell us about acquaintance rape. What is that? I think we hear that term.
Yeah, I know. It's sort of interesting, because oftentimes I want to just say rape is rape. It doesn't really matter who did it. I think sometimes with an acquaintance assault versus a stranger assault, I think even with as much education as there's been about that it's much more likely to be somebody that the person knows, we're still all kind of ingrained to feel like it's the stranger assault that's more likely to happen. And I think with the stranger assault, there is often more times of fear of being killed,
right?
Of not only being raped, but being killed.
Right.
And it's not 100%, but certainly
well,
I think
we've certainly seen that. It recently in our community with a real high profile case.
Absolutely. And I think with the acquaintance assault, or when it's an assailant that the person knows, that then there's a more significant loss of trust.
Right.
Because this person you went out with on a date, or this, I don't know if people even date anymore, but this person that you hooked up with, or maybe this person you had consensual sex with before, is now doing something that you don't want them to do. There's a much more significant loss of trust in that other person and trust in yourself to know that you're to feel like you should have been able to see this coming. I think there's still a lot of victim blaming in society, and I think a lot of survivors still feel like that they did something to make it be their fault.
Or didn't do something that could have stopped it. I mean,
right.
We hear that as well.
It's just, it's amazing how when I've been in the emergency department with survivors, just telling them it's not their fault is just, I mean, there's simple words, but it means so much to that person sitting there, because I think we've been kind of trained to, and I say we, I'm kind of meaning women in a lot of ways, we've been trained to feel like we should be able to prevent something from happening, especially in an acquaintance situation or in a dating situation. So I think the assault itself is still the same, but the kind of the feelings afterwards can be different with a stranger assault versus somebody that the person knows.
Yeah. And you know, that whole issue of, you know, in a difficult situation, maybe there's alcohol involved, to be able to assert that prerogative to say no, or feel how difficult that can be in that situation. I mean, that's where I think the prevention work is so critically important.
Yeah, a lot of college campuses are looking at prevention, they're really looking at building bystander skills.
Right.
So that the friend who sees his or her friend really drunk just says, don't do it tonight.
Right.
You know, she's too drunk, you're too drunk, whatever, just don't do it tonight. And that's where that friend intervening can make, you know, I think we all know alcohol clouds our judgment.
Right.
And I think saying, well, just don't drink that much, it's not really viable on most college campuses.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such the norm.
But I think that's where a bystander stepping in, where somebody else stepping in and saying, you know, saying to a guy, no, dude, just leave her alone.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's get her home.
Right.
I mean, we have UVA in our backyard, which is just, it just sort of, it's like, why does somebody want to have sex with somebody who's drunk and non-participatory?
Right.
It just doesn't make any, it's not sex is what I want to say.
Indeed, it's not.
And I think that's where we kind of have to change the framework of thinking of the ultimate piece being sex and kind of going, well, maybe the ultimate piece is a relationship, and maybe you do that another day when you're both sober.
Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning on the Mind and Heart Show, I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier, and our guest this morning is Becky Waybright, who is the executive director of Charlottesville Sexual Assault Resource Agency. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in the final minutes of our show with Becky with some more questions, so please stay with us. And welcome back, Charlottesville, to the Mind and Heart Show on 94.7 WPVC. We are the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and we're here every Saturday morning dealing with all matters of the mind and heart. So thanks very much for joining us. We're in the final few minutes of our show, and our guest this morning is Becky Waybright from the Sexual Assault Resource Agency here in Charlottesville, and she's been giving us lots of good information on this subject, which is a critically important subject. You know, Becky, I once heard a colleague talk about sexual assault as a public health problem. And what he meant was, and perhaps you could speak to this, was that it doesn't just affect the one person. It's a ripple effect. That person, if they don't aren't able to obtain treatment, can impact those around them and the families and the caregivers and their own children. It's costing us as a society billions of dollars, it has to, in terms of the fallout from this problem.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And the person who's been the victim of sexual assault will often have health issues later on in their life if they haven't had a chance to deal with it. And there is a cost to it.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact figure, but I think the estimate is over $100,000 that it costs our society for each sexual assault that happens. And that can be lost productivity. It can be, you know, which kind of has a multiple level of impact for somebody. It can be cost to the criminal justice system. It just is much more than just the time of the assault. And there is a perspective that does look at sexual violence as being a public health issue. I'm kind of interested in looking at it in whatever angle I can get that person to hear me the best.
Yeah.
If it's talking about it being public health, that's great. If it's talking about it just being wrong, that's great. If it's talking about it to somebody who's got, you know, a parent of kids, it's like, well, let's talk about how we can try to keep your kids from either being perpetrators or being victims.
Right. And you know, going back to the issue of so-called acquaintance rape, I mean, very often I know for the prosecutors, if that's a he said, she said, that's going to be a tough case to win, because a lot of juries don't want to send a guy away just on one other person's allegations. And I know that must impact the survivors in terms of their response to not being heard.
It is. I think with adult survivors, we, with our sexual assault response team, we've actually been talking about this a lot lately, is how do we improve the criminal justice response so that survivors, they would call them victims, but that the victim feels comfortable going forward with the court process. Because oftentimes when cases aren't prosecuted, it may be the victim who's backing out and just says, I don't want to do this, or
right,
it's feeling really horrible, and they don't want to go forward. So it's sort of like, how can we, from the first point of contact forward, how can we make sure our system is responding to that survivor in the best way possible so that we can potentially have a successful prosecution? It's tough. It's really
very
tough with adult cases. Yeah. There's,
and the system's intimidating. I mean, I think a lot of women are, well, I guess some men too, you know, it just feels very scary. And I think that's where you come in terms of court advocacy. You probably work with the victim witness coordinators.
I do. Mm-hmm.
And the two prosecutor's offices, or more than, I mean,
right,
all the prosecutor's offices in the area.
Right. We do. We work with all of those. I think a lot of cases never even get that far.
Right.
It may be that this, you know, we do, when we are in the emergency department, we do a lot of blind reports, and that's where forensic nurse examiner will go ahead and do the physical evidence recovery kit, but it's not reported to the police. And And the person has the choice to decide if they do later want it reported to the police. But a lot of people just want to get over it. And want to heal and kind of move forward. And it may be, especially for adult survivors, it may be that then they actually come to an agency like ours. It may be 3, 4, 5 years down the road that they come. We do see some percentage of the people we see in the emergency department do come in for services with us, but a lot of them we don't see. We've kind of talked about a couple different scenarios with that. Sometimes, you know, we don't know the answer, but a lot of people do have strong support systems and they do have strong family behind them and they will access those support systems. So they may not come to us because they may not need us because they've got people around them who believe them. Yeah. I try to hang on to that positive scenario versus other scenarios.
And is it ever discussed in these situations that part of what can happen is if they do come forward, it may then prevent further victimization of other people down the road? I mean, that's something I always felt strongly about.
Yeah, but it's not that victim's job to stop the perpetrator.
Okay.
It just... I mean, I hear that and I understand it. And I know there are times I've felt that myself, but it's, you know, that's where our role again is straightforward. We support the victim and whatever the survivor and whatever choice.
So it's really not your job to make that argument. It might be the prosecutor's job to make
the
that
prosecutor
argument.
Might, somebody else might, but our job is to support the survivor and whatever choices she or he wants to make.
Yeah. Do you feel that there's been adequate training and awareness in the Charlottesville and Elmore Police Departments in terms of the sensitivity of this issue? Do they have designated people to talk to victims?
Yeah, they do. The investigators are the current term being used now is trauma informed, and a lot of the investigators are really good at that. We've been trying to work a little bit to figure out whether because it may be the patrol officer who's the first responder.
Yeah.
And what we don't want is that person to ask the wrong questions that might. That might actually turn the whole situation from the survivor being interested in going forward to her saying
no.
So we've been looking at some things and trying to develop a training for those patrol officers to just kind of keep it as simple as possible so they can determine whether they need to get an investigator there and then let the investigator come in and do his or her work once they're called in. I personally have not seen that. I mean, I think the police have come a long ways from when I was in this field before.
Mm-hmm.
There still is that sense of why was she there? What did she do? Why did she do that?
Why did she wear that dress? I mean,
we do. I mean, we certainly do still hear that. I think I have a filter that blocks those things out because I have to do it for self-preservation.
Yeah.
But I think that still is there a lot in society.
Yeah, those attitudes.
And I think we need to switch that around. We need to say, why did that person think it was okay to rape her?
Right, right.
Why does anybody think that's okay?
Yeah. And what are the underpinnings, the attitudes, again, the sense of entitlement, all the things that I think can contribute to that. Do you see or hear about many women perpetrators?
Certainly some, but not very often.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it does happen, and I think when it does happen, it's oftentimes a adult female with a child.
Right.
You know, it's not unheard of for it to happen with an adult woman with an adult male. I think then the male survivor even feels more like it was his fault.
Yeah.
And there's something wrong with him. It's certainly not. You know, the vast majority of perpetrators are male.
Yeah. But, you know, I've had cases over the years, and I think this attitude is still out there, where if, say, an adolescent boy is seduced by a teacher, an adult, you know, that's not a sexual assault. That's, hey, lucky guy. He got lucky. And yet you talk to those kids, and it's traumatic.
Right. I've had more than one male friend whose first sexual encounter was with an adult woman. You know, he was 13 or 14.
Right.
And the ones that I talked to at depth about that, and this was a friend situation, not in a, you know, work relationship, but they didn't really describe it as like a woohoo, that was great. It was just, they didn't describe it as an assault, but it was not described as something that was, there was just, you know, they had odd feelings about it.
Yeah. But it was always striking to me when I'd worked with those guys in therapy, when I define it that way, that you see the light bulb kind of go off like, oh, no one ever told me that perhaps I shouldn't, you know, that I should feel this way. You know, the idea was you got lucky, not, you know, this scary, confusing, didn't understand it, felt out of control, you know, still have nightmares about it, whatever.
Yeah, it's a reality.
Yeah, it really is. Well, we're going to run out of time, unfortunately, and I still have a bunch of questions. But let's talk just generally about the criminal justice system, because I know that, again, your role is with the victim, the survivor. But I wonder if you feel that the current statutes as they exist are adequate. Are they addressing this issue adequately?
It's really challenging. I think some of the changes we've seen happen with legislation specifically around sexual assault on college campuses, in terms of things having to be reported to the police. I think what I've seen locally happen is people are not coming forward. Students who have been victimized by sexual assault are not coming forward because they are afraid that things are going to be reported to the police against their wishes.
Right.
And I think sometimes legislators make decisions about legislation, and then we may find out later on it needs to be tweaked or changes need to be made. I don't know that we really know all the answers. I think we are committed, at least a lot of us are committed as a society, to want to try to lessen the amount of sexual violence that happens. And there is certainly a legislative and legal piece that's a part of that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I recently finally got around to reading Liz Sicuro's book. For those of you who aren't familiar, I believe it's called Crash Into Me. But she was the woman who had been sexually assaulted 20, 30 years ago at UVA and got really brushed aside by all the authorities at the time. And then some years later, the perpetrator had gotten into a 12-step program and in an effort to make amends had reached out to her and resulted in his being charged. But that book, and I recommend it, is harrowing. I mean, the account that she gives is just horrifying.
I am happy to say that I think things have improved at least somewhat.
Yes, that was my point. I knew I was going somewhere with that. Thank you for picking up the point.
Yeah, because I think her assault was in 1984.
Right.
I think it's still tough on college campuses. It's a really, and you know, stats are horrible for the amount of sexual violence that happens on college campuses.
And we're not just picking on UVA. No. Let's be clear about that. I think
it's Google anybody. You can find
any school.
Yale, you know, Tennessee. There are lots of schools that have had issues that have happened related to sexual violence. UVA is not, you're not unique. If that were the situation, we could fix it. But it's endemic around college campuses across the country.
Yeah. And she talks about in there, in retrospect, you know, if someone had just intervened or said to her or stepped up, a friend or whomever, a bystander, you know, it could have changed the whole outcome. And again, I think that's why those programs are critically important.
And I think that some of what we're seeing happening is bystander reports are growing. So that's a good first step on college campuses.
Yeah, it really is. I just wanted to ask you before we wrap up this morning about funding for Sarah. What can folks, our listeners, do to help, to either make donations or volunteer? I mean, how is Sarah funded? I'm sure you're dealing with a patchwork of agencies and funding sources.
We are. We do get a lot of funding that comes from the federal government through the state. That's pretty a significant chunk of our budget. We also get funding locally from some of our counties and the city of Charlottesville. We can always use private donations. That's money that typically has a little bit less strings attached to it, and a few or less grant reports. So we're always thrilled to get donations from the community. I also wanted to be sure to put out our hotline number if I can do that.
Absolutely, please do.
So that's 434-977-7273, and that's available 24/7 if anybody has any questions or any concerns that they want to ask. Our office number, if people want to call and support us in whatever way, is 434-295-7273. We're also always happy to have volunteers. We use volunteers on our hotline. We use volunteers for outreach. We're happy to have volunteers come in and help us with administrative and clerical tasks in our office, too.
But you do, there is training, I know, for hotline and service-related volunteers on the
ISERA. Yes, we have an extensive training program. We really want people to be prepared as possible to answer any kind of questions. We don't know when you answer the hotline. You don't know what the question might be.
Mm-hmm. And you have an active board of directors as a nonprofit that sort of oversees the operation and the funding. And
yeah, I'm happy to say we have an active and very engaged board of directors.
Yeah.
And thank you for having been on our board.
Yeah, I mean, it was a wonderful experience.
Good.
And I was, you know, it's something I believe strongly in addressing. So, yeah. So we're just about out of time this morning. A couple of announcements. Stay tuned for Andra Hakes coming up at the top of the hour on Straight Talk. We will be back next week. My guest will be Dan Grogan, who is working in the area of voting rights. And we'll be talking about that and the impact of disenfranchisement on voters and what that portends for the upcoming election, national and statewide elections. So please join us next week, and you can listen to the show, this morning's show on podcast. Go to Cville Podcast, one word, CVILLEPOWCAST.com. Just put in the search box Mind and Heart, and today's interview with Becky Waybright will come up if you joined us late or didn't have a chance to listen to the whole show. So thanks again to Morgan Geyer, my producer this morning, for doing a terrific job. And we will be back next week. So please join us at 9 o'clock next Saturday. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Mind and Heart Show with your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. Be sure and tune in again next Saturday morning at 9 o'clock for another edition of the Mind and Heart Show, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.